Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How would the world be different if no living person had read a sonnet by William Shakespeare? If the bard himself had had his way, we would in fact be living without most of the 150-odd poems included in the collection, because unlike his well-known and well-preserved stage works, Shakespeare's sonnets were about his personal life. And as contemptible a reputation as copyright violators have now and had then, we do owe an enormous debt of gratitude to the quirky and unscrupulous 17th-century stationer who collected and sold them. Clinton Halen is a writer and English history scholar specializing in Jacobean and Elizabethan works. He explains what probably happened in his new book, So Long as Men Can Breathe, The Untold Story of Shakespeare's Sonnets. Clinton, welcome to Think.
Welcome. Thanks.
You open the book with a wonderful quote from Hyder Rollins, and if you don't have it in front of you, perhaps you can paraphrase it for us.
Well, I do actually have it in front of you, so I probably can read it verbatim.
Wonderful.
The greatest advantage of Shakespearean studies seems to be that questions may be asked over and over again, and that almost nobody pays attention to the answers, unless he borrows them for his own use in an article or a book.
Which I suppose is certainly the case. You have paid attention to all of these things and listened to them, but you have your own ideas about exactly what happened with the sonnets.
Well, essentially, I am trying to bring together kind of received wisdom from 250 years of scholarship. I'm not claiming any great breakthrough in thinking. I'm just trying to kind of sort the wheat from the chaff and maybe kind of turn right way up a lot of the ideas that have kind of been propagated over the last 30 or 40 years that are in complete reverse of everything that previously came.
Start us off with a little refresher on the sonnets for those who haven't picked up a copy for a while. We think of them exclusively as love poems, but in fact they stray into sex and gender roles and human flaws, even politics.
Well, I mean, there are 154 sonnets. I suggest that they break down into four parts. Most people would suggest they break down into three. The first 17 sonnets are what are called the marriage sonnets, which appear to be cajoling a young man into seeing the wisdom of marriage and propagating. And then the sonnets from 18 to 125 or 126, depending on your point of view, are the so-called fair youth sonnets. And as I suggest in the book, that sequence is almost certainly modelled on Sir Philip Sidney's Astrophil and Stella, which is also a 108 sonnet sequence. And then finally, there are the so-called Dark Lady sonnets, which most people assign as 28 sonnets. I suggest they're 26 sonnets, and that the last two sonnets in the collection are in fact fakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they are not uniform in quality to the others.
They're appalling, in fact. as W.H. Auden said, it is inconceivable that Shakespeare would have put sonnets of such poor worth right at the end of a collection, even if he'd have put them inside a collection. The idea that he would end such an important collection with two sonnets, which one, repeat themselves, and two, really aren't worthy of him, raises serious questions.
And one of those is the one called A Lover's Complaint, is that right?
The Lover's Complaint comes after the sonnets. I suggest in the book that the author of the two fake sonnets was probably the same man who was responsible for this long poem in what's called Rhyme Royal, A Lover's Complaint.
Who would Shakespeare have given copies to?
Well, again, this is a hugely contentious issue because, the straight answer is we don't know. But we do have a reference from a text published in 1598 by a gentleman called Francis Meir that certain of the sonnets were handed around in manuscript. Now, we know that for a fact. Two of those sonnets were, in fact, published the following year in another bootleg production called The Passionate Pilgrim. So there certainly were some sonnets in, if you like, discrete circulation. I suggest that the so-called fair youth sonnets, the main sequence, which deals with an infatuation with a young gentleman, were in fact not discreetly circulated, that they almost certainly were only ever in the hands of three or four people, and that the version that passed to the publisher of the sonnets was almost certainly obtained surreptitiously.
So let's step back and talk for a moment about the publishing business in Jacobean England. How were works, legally anyway, bought and printed and distributed?
Oh, well, the answer is that publishers owned the copyright on any book they published, and they owned it in perpetuity. How they acquired those works that they published is not at all clear-cut, because they didn't necessarily buy them from the writer. In fact, they had no legal obligation to buy them from the writer. The writer of a work had no legal rights. So if the publisher got his hand on a manuscript of yours, tough. As soon as he registered it with the stationer's company, it was his property. And he could do with it as he saw fit. Of course, in Shakespeare's case, the real bane of his life wasn't bootlegs of his poems, but bootlegs of his plays, because something like 40 different bootleg editions of his plays were published, often bastardized texts, I mean not reliable texts, during his own lifetime. And of course, that cut directly into his income, because it meant that other companies could put on his plays, and people might not go and see his plays if they felt that they could read them, and not have to wade through the mud.
And efforts to prevent this went so far that many times even actors weren't given an entire copy of the script. They were sort of given a few lines before their line would happen, and that was all they knew of a work.
Yes, I mean, most actors, as far as we know, were given these things called cue scripts, and they were literally their own parts, and that was all. And as you say, they would have a verbal prompt for where they came in and where they obviously ended their speech. But they were never given the full text of the play for exactly that reason, that unscrupulous publishers would bribe players to allow them access to a copy of the text, which, of course, they would then have copied and return. So, I mean, it's still a slightly grey area. I mean, people aren't really clear how all of the Shakespearean quartos, almost all of which we assume were not approved, were actually obtained. And as I suggest in the book, the key character in this story, aside from the publisher Thomas Thorpe and William Shakespeare himself, is a gentleman called John Davies of Hereford, who not only was a pretty hack poet in his own right, but also was what was called a writing master. That was someone who actually wrote out beautiful copies and could write very expeditiously and very neatly. And I suggest, because we know for a fact that John Davies was a huge Shakespeare fan and he drops Shakespeare's name into many of his poems, that that Davies almost certainly would have gone down to the theatre and actually transcribed the plays for his own use.
You know, I'm not an actor, but it seems like it would be incredibly hard in the dramatic process to really get your role down if you didn't know the whole work.
It does seem extraordinary to us, but, obviously we're dealing with a much more oral culture. I mean, the interaction between oral and literary in Elizabethan and Jacobean times would have been completely different from what we're used to. I mean, oral culture was in a hugely important part of the literary scene. I mean, there are well over 1,000 words that are credited to Shakespeare as the first person to use them in a literary sense. But we have absolutely no idea whether hundreds of those words could have been in common usage in oral tradition. We just don't know. So the fact of the matter is that I think that the actors in the Elizabethan era would have been much more comfortable with the idea of, learning their part and being able to slot it in.
You mentioned earlier the registration of certain works, that once you had gone to the stationers and sort of filled out some paperwork, you would have the right to print it. Can you talk about what that process required?
Well, the stationers' company was set up during the reign of Queen Mary, basically for censorship. It was nothing to do with letting publishers make a living. It was just so that the Crown could control what was said, you know, in print. You know, and the various acts that were passed in the 50-year period we're talking about are largely concerned with that. And the penalties were very severe, you know, if you publish something that you really shouldn't have. So it was really about that. The whole point of registering was that it gave you as a publisher, the printer, a legal right to that work. And no one else could then come in and publish that work without your permission. But from the Crown's point of view, as I say, it was about ensuring that things were not published that said things that were religiously problematic or indeed, you know, were problematic in terms of the Crown itself.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Thomas Thorpe, the guy who did, in fact, publish these sonnets. He was not quite spectacularly unsuccessful at his work.
Well, Thorpe is a fascinating character, and it's frustrating that we know so little about him. One of the things that we didn't know until very, very recently, I mean, literally within the last 30 years, is that not only was he a Catholic, which, of course, at that time would have been a problem in itself. Remember, 1609 is just after the gunpowder plot. But secondly, that he was almost certainly a spy for the Crown. So he had this kind of dual existence. Certainly on the basis of what he published, it's very hard to believe that he made much of a living as a publisher, because he published something between one and three books a year for something like a 12, 13-year period. And before and after that, he published almost nothing. And yet, you know, he somehow kept body and soul together. He had a short flirtation with literary London, if you like. He published between 1606 and 1608 works by John Marston and George Chapman and Ben Jonson, all of whom were very important figures in that particular milieu. But he had, as far as we know, no connection with Shakespeare, and there's never been one that's ever been successfully established.
English history scholar Clinton Halen is my guest. We're talking about his new book, So Long as Men Can Breathe, The Untold Story of Shakespeare's Sonnets. So Thorpe had been in hot water before for printing things that did not belong to him. Is that right?
In fact, twice. Mm-hmm. In the same year. The first year he really published anything of consequence in 1603, he twice attempted to publish something that another stationer had already registered. And it's all very well ripping off authors. That's no problem at all. But when you start ripping off other publishers, that gets you a bad reputation.
What kind of legal recourse did the rightful owner have?
Oh, a significant recourse, because to start with, they could be fined anything up to £300. Now, £300 was an astronomical sum in that time. To give you an idea, if he purchased the sonnet, he would have paid somewhere between £2 and £3. So that tells you how significant the fine could be.
Do you think he probably did pay for them?
I'm almost convinced he paid for them. I mean, essentially, there's no other way that he could have got his hands on them, because it's curious that he should have ended up being the publisher, because by 1609, Shakespeare was the most successful playwright in London. He was a huge name. He was a huge success. He was his company was the king's men. He had the mandate of the king. And a collection of poems by that author would have been a very valuable literary property. So he must have paid for it.
Clinton Halen is my guest. We're talking about his new book, So Long as Men Can Breathe, The Untold Story of Shakespeare's Sonnets. You can join us after the break by calling now. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is English history scholar Clinton Halen. His new book is called So Long as Men Can Breathe, The Untold Story of Shakespeare's Sonnets. If you'd like to ask a question or join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So let's talk about why Shakespeare would not have wanted these sonnets published. Some of them may have been written for sort of wealthy benefactors and were sort of personal documents in that way. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, the problem is that, I mean, all sonneteers had wealthy patrons in those days. But if you read the kind of sonnets that Shakespeare's contemporaries were writing versus what Shakespeare's writing, it's much more private, it's much more personal. You know, this clearly isn't about a patron-poet relationship, or at least not purely a patron-poet relationship. There's something much more personal going on.
Yeah, I know that some scholars have argued that even the sort of dedications that Shakespeare includes in some of these seem as if they might have been appropriate between a writer and a patron and not conveyed some sort of special personal and sexual relationship.
Yes, I mean the problem is that a lot of the criticism that has been written comes from an era when a distaste for even the possibility that that Shakespeare may have been a pederast overwhelms very responsible literary critics. I mean, C.S. Lewis, a truly great critic, just cannot bring himself to consider Shakespeare as having, if you like, consummated a relationship with a young man. So he just cannot get past that, and therefore it colors completely his criticism of the poem.
Would public knowledge of that have hurt his career in his own time?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, Christopher Marlowe, shortly before his death, was due to be hauled up in front of the Privy Council for making an indiscreet comment, along the lines of anyone who doesn't like young boys is a fool. the actual punishments for the physical act were rather severe, death. I mean, in fairness, that there's almost no documented instance of that ever being carried out. But yes, I mean the penalties were extremely severe. And separately from that, there is this issue of the actual social divide. If the person that he was writing about, as appears to be the case, was a gentleman and possibly even a peer, then the social gulf was so huge that he could have been in very serious difficulties if that had been made public.
So, Clinton, was this the kind of thing he would have also kept hidden from his closest friends, or do you think they knew?
Well, it's, given the lack of documentation we have about Shakespeare's life in London at that time, and given the gregariousness of so much of literary London, I think it's safe to assume that he didn't have many close friends, that he kept people at a certain distance, at a certain remove. Certainly not uncommon for a writer. Even somebody like Ben Jonson, who he clearly respected as a playwright, you know, the information that we have suggests that even then, bosom buddies would not be the expression one would use.
So Thorpe gets this collection from someone and pays some amount for it. Do we have any idea how many editions he actually, or how many copies he actually put out?
We have no idea how many copies he put out, but clearly it was a small number, by which I mean he probably printed between 300 and 500 copies initially. It would appear that that's all he printed, by which I mean there never was a second edition, and it's very, very unlikely there was ever a second printing. We know that because there are only 13 surviving copies, which is a very small number. Now, quartos were pretty flimsy. I mean, they're like a Pulp Fiction book. They were unbound, and people did read them until they fell apart. So you know, 13 surviving copies doesn't necessarily mean a small print run. However, we have no contemporary documentation about this publication. We have nobody referring to it. We have nobody talking about Shakespeare's sonnets. We have nobody even quoting from Shakespeare's sonnets until much, much later. So it would appear that it was a spectacular failure, which is surprising.
Yeah.
Because Shakespeare at that point was a hugely well-known figure.
Well, distribution was an issue for Thorpe, wasn't it?
It was only an issue for him personally, by which I mean he just couldn't get his act together to the point of being able to distribute it himself, so he got two other booksellers to do the distribution. The two booksellers he got, though, were what would be termed big hitters. I mean, one of them became master of the Stationers' Company, the highest position you could have in printing and publishing. So that wouldn't have been an issue. He had two very good distribution outlets. The most curious thing about it is that he never sold on the copyright. Now, a publisher in those days owned the copyright on the book in perpetuity. And even if he chose not to republish the book, the question is, why did he never sell the rights to another publisher? He lived until at least 1635, so 26 years after the book was published. And there is nowhere in the Stationer's Register is it recorded that he sold the copyright.
Well, it is interesting because it seems, especially after 1616, that there would have been a renewed interest in these.
Well, I mean, obviously, the publication of the first folio in 1623 is the key event in terms of the publishing history, because that proved there was a huge demand for Shakespeare. I mean, a hugely expensive book and 1,000 copies of a folio. That was a massive print run. And of course, the second folio followed fairly quickly, 1632. So, and there were a lot of quartos published in the interim of Shakespeare's plays. So why his poems would not have been picked up is a great mystery. And as I just pointed out, one of the distributors of the original edition had by this point become master of the Stationers' Company.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. English history scholar Clinton Haitlin is my guest. His new book is called So Long as Men Can Breathe, The Untold Story of Shakespeare's Sonnets. Let's go to John in Dallas. Hello, John.
Hi, listen, I had maybe a comment and a sort of a clarification. You talked earlier about the fact that actors did not get the entire copy of the script, and it sort of sounded as if you felt that they were being done a great disservice. But in fact, that's been common practice and still is common practice in many areas of the theater. Music theater publishers rarely give the entire script to the characters, the actors with the small parts. And it's done more for reasons of economy than it is for reasons, even in Shakespeare's time, for reasons of fearing the republication of the script. It's just that it's expensive and time-consuming to copy the entire script, particularly if you have to do it by hand. The other thing that I wanted to say was, I wonder if you guys would comment on the fact that, one of the possible reasons that Shakespeare's sonnets were not widely available for purchase was that Shakespeare, I don't believe myself, ever really thought of them as commercial entities at all, but rather, as your guest said, as private sort of communications. And so I'll listen to you talk about that.
Thanks for your call.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Well, I mean, obviously the first point is perfectly valid. I mean, the cost of transcriptions of plays would have been extremely punitive if you were giving them to the whole cast. But I don't think there's any doubt that part of the rationale behind Q scripts was to stop the circulation of full copies of the text. In relation to the question of whether Shakespeare himself would have considered them commercial, in a sense, that's not really relevant because he had no say. I mean, you know, it's not like he went on a promotional tour for his books because he didn't publish any books. He didn't publish any works in his lifetime except two long poems published in the mid-1590s, both of which were published with permission. The sonnets, as I said earlier, were published at a time when he was extremely well known, when there was a plethora of bootleg quartos of his plays. In fact, there were two bootleg quartos of his plays published within 3 months, one of which was printed by the same printer who published Shakespeare's sonnets. Now, the play in question was immediately reprinted, but the poems weren't, which suggests there was a problem. The second point that I would make is that one of the poems is circulated in manuscript only, the second of the sonnets. There are as many manuscript copies surviving from the first half of the 17th century as there are surviving copies of Thomas Thorpe's edition. I mean, that's how rare the actual published edition is.
Any indication that Shakespeare found out what Thorpe had done?
There is. The book was registered on the 20th of May, 1609. And obviously we slightly cheated because we published my book, you know, on the 400th anniversary of the publication, but it's not the publication, it's the registration mm-hmm. of the book. It doesn't necessarily follow that it's published immediately on registration, but as far as we know, it was published very quickly after that registration. The interesting thing is that we do have documentary evidence that Shakespeare fled London in the first week in June. Hmm. Now, we can interpret the reason why he left London for Stratford in a million different ways, because all we know is that he turned up in Stratford at a court case on a defaulter, someone he'd lent money to who didn't repay him. And, you know, if you take that at face value, you'd say, well, of course, why wouldn't he? But you actually have to look at it a bit deeper than that. The fact of the matter is that the debt in question was about £5.
So not that, enough to justify.
That, well, the point is that his income around that time was we estimate was about £250 a year. To travel to Stratford was a two-day ride each way. And although he got a judgment in the case in his favour, he never got the money because the guy just didn't turn up in court. Now, all of these tell us that it's pretty unlikely. This was a smart man and a very shrewd man about money. Would he really have given up that amount of time and energy to turn up in a court case that he had almost no chance of getting the money? I mean, from what we know, he never did get the money. I suggest in the book, and I'm not alone in this, that in fact it was a ruse, that he got out of town because he needed to get out of town.
So let's talk about something that the people in your business have been arguing about for centuries, and that is this very strange sort of dedication at the very beginning of the book. Can you tell us what it says?
Yes. I mean, it is, as you say, an extraordinarily famous dedication. It certainly must be one of the worst written dedications of all time. But what it actually says is, to the only begetter of these ensuing sonnets, Mr. W.H., all happiness and that eternity promised by our ever-living poet, wisheth the well-wishing adventurer in setting forth, T.T., which obviously means Thomas Thorpe.
So virtually every phrase within that dedication has been argued about, but let's start with this one, only begetter. What could that mean?
Well, what it could mean and what it does mean are two entirely separate things. of course, it could mean the only procurer, i.e. the person who actually obtained the sonnets, whether surreptitiously or legitimately. The curious thing about that is, if it was someone who procured the sonnets, why the only begetter? I mean, obviously, you can only have one procurer. So in that sense, that would be curious. The question obviously then is the begetter the person who inspired the sonnets? And that, of course, that really is opens up a can of worms. The other curious thing that is controversial, obviously, is the fact that he dedicates it to a Mr. W.H. Now, if has been suggested, the person who was the fair youth in the poems was indeed the begetter. It seems extremely unlikely that he would have been referred to as a mister, which would just mean a gentleman, as opposed to either a peer somebody with a title.
Yeah, and it's not the sort of mistake that Shakespeare would have made accidentally.
No, absolutely not, no. But it is possible that is the sort of mistake that Thorpe would have made. Thorpe certainly had pretensions to be a literary, a well-read individual, but all of his dedications are pretty convoluted and show that his command of English wasn't exactly 100%. So it is possible that the WH that he's dedicating it to was a name that was already on the manuscript. It's not at all uncommon for these manuscripts that were passed around in those times to have a dedication on them. And if it was dedicated to WH, it may be that Thorpe actually added, you know, the title, thinking that that's what he should do.
So, in other words, Thorpe might have taken a few words by Shakespeare and added in all this padding around them.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it seems unlikely that he would have known the identity of the fair youth, however he came by the manuscript. It's extremely unlikely. I mean, he had a long history of bitching about patrons in his dedication. So it's very unlikely that he's dedicating it to this person because, you know, he feels some great, desire to, build him up.
He wasn't kissing up, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's talk in a minute after this break about who the fair youth might have been. There are a few candidates, and you have a favorite. Clinton Halen is my guest. He is an English history scholar whose new book is called So Long as Men Can Breathe, The Untold Story of Shakespeare's Sonnets. If you've got a question, you can ask it now at 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Clinton Halen is my guest. He's a Jacobean and Elizabethan English history scholar, and his new book is called So Long as Men Can Breathe, The Untold Story of Shakespeare's Sonnets. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. Okay, so Clinton, we have the fair youth, and we don't know exactly who this is, but there are several likely candidates, including the Earl of Southampton and the Earl of Pembroke.
Yes, I mean the interesting thing is that, of course, no one came up with a candidate for 250 years. and then suddenly there was a flurry. The Victorians decided that it was high time we found out who might be possible, and of course the war has raged ever since 1817, which is the first time that somebody really puts forward a serious candidate. And essentially, it divides down to yes, whether you are a Southamptonite or a Pembrokean. I mean, it's it's perfectly possible it's another, but nobody has yet come forward with any other credible candidate.
Well, I know that you are a Pembrokean, but let's start with the case that the Southamptonites make.
Well, of course, the Earl of Southampton has the huge advantage of being the only person that we know Shakespeare definitely dedicated a poem to. In fact, he definitely dedicated two poems to, which is Venus and Adonis and The Rape of Lucretia. And, of course, those were the two poems that he had published in his lifetime that were authorized. You know, that they were Shakespeare's own, you know, chosen, works, published with permission.
Any resemblance to the Fair Youth poems?
No. I mean, they're written in rhyme royale, they're obviously both long poems. They're much more ornate. They're much more formalized, you know. And to a modern taste, I would have to say, for non-English graduates, they're harder going. I mean, they're much more stylized. They're much more indicative of a grammar school education, if you like. Whereas the sonnets, you know, people read them now and they feel modern. That's one of the interesting things about them, you know, that because there's that sense that you're getting an insight into who this person is, which of course is not the case with either of those two poems.
So they're not intimate in the same way at all.
No. The first one, Venus and Adonis, was dedicated to the Earl of Southampton, who, by his own admission, Shakespeare had yet to meet. You know, he makes a dedication, if you like, as a pitch. You know, he's trying to get a patron. A year later, he publishes Rape of Lucretia, and obviously his pitch worked, because this time he dedicates it to the Earl of Southampton in very glowing terms and clearly intimate terms. I mean, there clearly is a bond now, and, it is essentially the argument for the Earl of Southampton comes down to that, comes down to the fact that he is a known patron of Shakespeare, the known patron, if you like.
And he did have the same two initials that are listed in that dedication, but they're reversed.
Yes, I mean, this is the real problem the Southamptonites have. Well, it's one of the many problems, actually, but is essentially that he doesn't have the right initials unless you invert them. And if you invert them, what's the point in dedicating it in the first place? I'm being slightly facetious, but the point I'm making is, if it's a deliberate purblind to reverse them, why bother at all? I mean, there is no point. I mean, you might as well just, have it as a secret. So that certainly is a problem. His name, Henry Wriothesley, with a W, isn't WH, it's HW. The other problem, and it's the real problem, is age. To typify Southampton as a fair youth when he was in his 20s by that point really is a stretch. The difference between Shakespeare and Southampton in age, I haven't got the thing in front of me actually, but I believe it's something like 9 years, which is not a huge difference.
And Shakespeare speaks throughout this series of sonnets about how he's sort of old and bald and not nearly as cool and good looking.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, Herbert, on the other hand, William Herbert, the Earl of Pembroke, has an enormous amount going for him. The age differential is much greater. If the poems were written between, say, 1595 and 1600. That fits perfectly with what we know of William Herbert, who was constantly, was coming up to London, who was heir to the earldom, who was constantly being berated by his parents to marry somebody, preferably somebody with lots of money. So all of the first 17 sonnets, which are the marriage sonnets, berating this guy to go out and marry someone, fit perfectly in with Herbert's. Like what we know of Herbert's lifestyle. And, of course, because both Herbert and Southampton were significant nobles, we know a lot about them, much, much, much more than we know about Shakespeare. Now, the interesting thing, though, about Herbert is that the Southamptonites would like you one to believe that that there's nothing really to connect him to Shakespeare. But of course, the first folio was dedicated to Pembroke and his brother. And in the dedication, the Heming and Condell, who published the first folio after Shakespeare's death, specifically refer to having prosecuted the two earls in question, the two brothers, having prosecuted the favour of Shakespeare when he was alive. You know, they use that exact expression. So we know that Herbert was not only known to Shakespeare, but acted in some way, helped him. You know, the candidacy of the two figures kind of stands along those lines.
And just to explain, the younger Pembroke brother was almost too young for consideration.
Yes, yes, much too young for consideration, yes. So, yes, nobody seriously considers the Earl of Montgomery, who was the other brother, the other Herbert, to be a serious contender.
So later on in the series, we have all of these poems about the Dark Lady. What are your speculations about who that might have been?
Well, I mean, one of the problems that that everybody has to address when they come to the sonnets is that, in a sense, everyone divides the sonnets into these two categories, the Fair Youth sonnets and the Dark Lady sonnets. And in a sense, they're completely inappropriate. They're inappropriate because the Fair Youth sonnets are, in fact, two sets of sonnets, the Marriage sonnets and the Fair Youth sonnets, completely distinct and almost certainly written at completely different times and for a completely different purpose. The Dark Lady sonnets, the 26 or the 28, depending on your point of view, aren't really about the Dark Lady. Some are, but they're a miscellany. You know, some of them, and some of them are very comic. You know, there's the three famous Will sonnets, where he just puns on the word Will endlessly to suggest that, you know, he's not getting to have his will. and, you know, so, and there are other sonnets, you know, just complaining. You know, the problem is in itself been created by this tag that it's been given. I mean, there is this shady character and, you know, she is described as dark as night. I mean, whether that's a physical description, we've no idea, to be honest. And her candidacy has never been nailed down. There have been several people who've, hung themselves, metaphorically at least, by coming forward with the name, only to have it shot down in flames. But we really have no idea who she might have been.
So given that the Fair Youth sonnets are so intimate and so direct, do you think it's possible that the Dark Lady sonnets are sort of a created character as opposed to a specific individual?
It's possible. I mean, I suspect she probably did exist. I suspect, though, that the Dark Lady sonnets were the ones that Francis Mir referred to in 1598, the ones that were handed around in manuscript. I mean, they read like that. They read like the sort of thing that everyone would have had a good laugh with at the pub. You know, I mean, you know, of course there's despair in there. Of course there's a lot of real emotions, but there's also a lot of showing off, a lot of, here, see how I deal with this genre, the sonnet. And there's also this sense that they're written over a period of time, whereas the Fair Youth sonnets have this intensity to them, as if it's almost a diary of an infatuation. And when you get to the end of them, you feel that everything is over. So it's a much more private piece of work. And as I suggest in the book, I believe that the Fair Youth sonnets were not circulated at all.
Now, it's also a raging debate as to when all of these were written, and they're laid out in an order in the books that we have today, and some people will claim to know quite certainly when they were penned, but in fact, there's no way to be sure.
No, and in fact, as I suggest in the book, I don't believe this is accidental. I believe that Shakespeare removed any references that would have timed the poems down. I mean, you know, he's far too clever a poet to have done that accidentally. I mean, you know, there are no references that tie to any specific event or any specific, you know, social occurrence that gives us, you know, something to hang it on. And of course, without knowing whether the poems themselves were ever revised, without knowing whether there was an intention to publish at some point, you know, we have no way of knowing whether the poems were written and then rewritten, or whether they were written over a span of time or written in 6 months, or, you know, so, I mean, the textual scholars are the ones that have fun with that. In a sense, I kind of leave it to them, you know. I'm prepared to state fairly unequivocally that they were written in the second half of the 1590s, but anything more precise than that, I leave to others.
And did they sort of disappear for a while?
What, the sonnets?
The sonnets.
Yeah, I mean, the sonnets, obviously, the sonnet fad itself was pretty much spent by the end of the 1590s, which is why their publication in 1609 is so curious. It's unlikely that by 1609 Shakespeare has become Shakespeare. You know, he's written Hamlet, he's written King Lear, he's the man. So, in a sense, there's no way that he would have made such a backward gesture, you know, published a work that was already something that, you know, was from a past self. There is this gap, you know, and we just don't know. The logical explanation is that it was being they were sitting in drawers or being passed round, or, you know, that they were being acquired. I suggest in my book, because my candidate for the person who surreptitiously obtained them is a gentleman called John Davies of Hereford, I do suggest that he had already obtained the sonnets by 1605. And the reason I suggest that is that John Davies published his own sonnet sequence in 1605, and it has several clues that he'd already read Shakespeare's sonnets, which, of course, had not been published.
So it's amazing to think that he probably sold these for just a few pounds.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing, I mean, again, when I started doing the research, did I find that John Davies's financial troubles in late 1608 were truly substantial. I mean, he had a serious tax bill and he had no money, and he desperately needed money. Interestingly enough, if he sold the manuscript to Thomas Thorpe, who was a fellow Catholic and who he almost certainly must have known because he knew all the other stationers who were involved in the publication. If he sold them to him at the end of 1608 and the first 2 months of 1609, he desperately needed the money. Even though he'd have only got £2 or £3, that was a lot of money to him at that point. The interesting thing is, at the end of February 1609, all of his financial problems went away, because he got a contract with Lord Percy for him to tutor his son, which suddenly meant that his financial problems were no longer anywhere near as acute.
In the 10 seconds we have left, does this force you to look at bootleggers with a slightly more tolerant eye?
I've always looked at them with a tolerant eye. I do consider them to be custodians of great works
that belong to the world and not just to one individual.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Clinton Halen is a writer and a scholar of English history. His new book is called So Long as Men Can Breathe, The Untold Story of Shakespeare's Sonnets. Clinton, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Yeah, no, pleased to do it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.